My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Welcome to Season 8. I can't believe it's Season 8 of this podcast. I also can't believe that by the time we get to the end of this season, we will have covered every single Bob Dylan studio album. I think it's probably a good place to stop the podcast after that. Quit while you're ahead, I always say. And sure, we could get lost in the weeds of the bootlegs. We could do a song-by-song season, I guess. I love the album. I'm fascinated by the album. I'm a dying breed in that regard. And I think it's a nice place to stop the podcast once we have got through all of Bob's studio albums. Some interesting albums to get to between now and then, though, including a classic, maybe a couple of classics, some terrible albums as well, and albums like the one we're going to feature on today's episode, which I guess is sort of in between all of that. Before we do get to that, let me remind you, if you have been a long-time listener to this podcast, or even a long-term listener, then please make sure you give us a review if you can do that wherever you're listening right now. And if you want to tip the podcast, you can do that as well. There's kind of an internet tipping system called Buy Me a Coffee, where you buy me a virtual coffee. I think they're like $3 each, maybe. You can buy as many as you want or as little as you want. They help to keep the podcast advert-free, and they help with all the kind of hosting fees and everything like that. So thank you to the following people that have done that. Hi to Michael A. Thomas, Ray Pod, hello to you. Craven Partners, thank you for your three coffees. Peter bought 10 coffees. Thank you for that, and thank you for a nice message as well. Carl, thank you to you. Hi to Doug Lindsay, Alan Ides. Hello to Peter, another Peter. Scott Peoples, hello to you. David Bradley, Davey Power. Hi to Domingo Peters and Mike Salisbury as well. You can find the link to the Buy Me a Coffee page. It'll be in the episode's description. Thank you in advance. Let's crack on, shall we? Let's start this final season by going back to the first ever album. This is 1962's Bob Dylan.
I've been around this whole country, but I never yet found Fenario. Well, as we march down, as we march down, well, as we march down to Fenario. Well, I kept you feeling in love with a lady like a dove. The name and its head was pretty peggy old.
It's almost fitting that in a career that has had it all, Dylan starts with a dud. Well, maybe that's not fair. It's not a dud, really, but it's obviously not Dylan's best album. This is partly due to its format, which is essentially a covers album. But it's interesting to view it in the context of today's artists who often break through with their debut, which often serves as their signature album in many cases. You'd expect the bright-eyed young Dylan to really hit the ground running with a smash album, but as usual, he defies expectation, and the world is introduced to the Columbia recording artist Bob Dylan in a ever-so-slightly muted way. In fact, if today's Dylan had released a studio album like this as his solo record, to kind of indifference from critics and slightly underwhelming sales, as he did on the 19th of March 1962, he may have been dropped by his label Columbia. Thankfully, artists had a little more time to build a career in the 60s. That's not to say there isn't a feeling of disappointment around this album. The record sold 5,000 copies in its first year, just enough to break even, which is not what was expected, especially considering that Dylan had been brought to a label by legendary Columbia talent scout John Hammond, a man who would discover Aretha Franklin and sign both Springsteen and Cohen. Not bad. Bob had met Hammond at a rehearsal session for the folk singer Carolyn Hester. This happened on the 14th of September 1961. It had taken place at her apartment. Hester had invited Dylan to the session as a harmonica player, and Hammond approved him as a session player after hearing him rehearse. Apparently this was the time when he decided to sign Dylan. In fact, he says he decided to sign him on the spot. He would invite him to the Columbia offices for a more formal audition recording. No record of that meeting has turned up in the Columbia vaults as of yet, but Hammond, Dylan and Columbia's A&R director Mitch Miller have all confirmed the audition did take place. So when Bob's album does fail to create any big fireworks, it must have been even more disappointing for Hammond, given his personal involvement with this new folk singer. In fact, Dylan for a short time was considered one of Hammond's rare misses. He was referred to as Hammond's folly, suggesting that Dylan was his kryptonite, his blind spot. There was even some minor talk that Bob would be dropped by Columbia, but this never really seems to materialise into anything concrete. So this album must have had enough moments to keep the label and listeners interested in Dylan's future. Well, yes, that is true. There's more than enough bright spots here to see the Dylan that would conquer the globe. And while I think the reassessment of this album in recent years has distorted its actual quality, as I mentioned in the intro, people often place it as a forgotten or misunderstood classic, which I don't agree with. There is still plenty to enjoy, though. No, it's not his best, but, you know, it's not his worst. It's not his most interesting or his most engaging even, but if nothing else, it is a fascinating origin story to the rest of Dylan's career.
Well, I don't know why I love you like I do. Nobody in the world can get along with you.
Cover songs, especially in the 60s, were familiar territory for a debut album, and here we have plenty, including You're No Good, a Jesse Fuller song. Fuller was an American one-man band musician, name-checked by Johnny Cash and the Grateful Dead as an influence. He is probably best known for his song San Francisco Bay Blues. When Dylan's debut comes out, the song was actually unreleased by Fuller, eventually appearing under its author's name in 1963. Bob had seen Jesse performing it as far back as 1959, though, and he'd learnt the song from him personally. He liked it so much, it becomes the starting point for his entire recording career. As we've seen with many of his covers, while this is not a Dylan original, it is a song that could easily be from him and by him. He has a habit of picking songs that would sound at home in his writing wheelhouse too. The opening lines could have easily been written by him for his freewheeling LP, say. They are, "Well, I don't know why I love you like I do. Nobody in the world can get along with you. You've got the ways of a devil sleeping in a lion's den. I come home last night, you wouldn't even let me in." Dylan had wanted to use a spoken introduction to this song about a cowboy in Connecticut, of course. But the idea was abandoned after interruptions in the early takes when Hammond complained that Dylan was popping the P sounds on the microphone, especially on the word plaints, which gives you a good insight to the music industry's freewheeling, if you excuse the pun, attitude towards recording at this point. Another cover on this album is called Fixing to Die. It was originally titled Fixing to Die Blues and was written by Delta Blues guitarist Bucker White. White wrote the song during his incarceration. He was serving 2.5 years for assault at the infamous Parchman Farm prison in Mississippi. While there, he wrote some of his most famous songs, including Shake 'Em On Down and Poor Boy, which wasn't an original of the Dylan song recorded for the album Love and Theft, sadly. While in jail, White witnessed the death of a friend, and he apparently got to wondering how a man feels when he dies. While delivering these lines about that, Dylan gives us a brilliant vocal performance.
And funny in my mind, Lord, I believe I'm fixing to die. Feeling funny in my mind, Lord, I believe I'm fixing to die. Well, I don't mind dying, but I hate to leave my children crying. Well, I go yonder to that barren ground. Look over yonder to that burying ground. Sure seems lonesome, Lord, when the sun goes down.
This, for me, is a major highlight of the album. Not the song as such, but Dylan's voice. There's some great performances on this LP. It's possibly one of the few things that Dylan can actually showcase here. For the most part, he's singing other people's words. No matter how close to his heart they are still another's. So his originality takes the form of his voice, to great effect in many moments, such as this song. There's also a fair amount of foreshadowing going on here too, with Curtis Jones's Highway 51. It's another great vocal performance from Dylan. He launches an assault with a guitar and a voice as his weapon. He sings, "Highway 51 runs right past my baby's door. Highway 51 runs right past my baby's door. If I don't get the girl I'm loving, won't go down to Highway 51 no more." You have to wonder at this point if there was an idea or even a concept that would lead Dylan to his own composition of Highway 61. Perhaps after this song had got under his skin, he felt a desire to write a more personal brother tune to this one. Highway 51 is very much a real road, a south-to-north road that runs from New Orleans, Louisiana, to the Wisconsin-Michigan state line. While, as we know, 61 is more relevant to Bob's life. It too is a real road, and it runs between New Orleans, Louisiana, to the city of Wyoming, in Bob's home state of Minnesota.
Highway 51 runs right by my baby's door. Thank you. Highway 51 runs right by my baby's door. If I don't get the gal I'm loving, won't go down Highway 51 no more.
There's another cover that closes this album. See That My Grave Is Kept Clean is a Blind Lemon Jefferson song, another standard among 60s folk revivalists, and one of a few songs here that is included on Harry Smith's legendary anthology of American folk music. Bob would record another version of it during the Basement Tapes era, but here it's very much in keeping with this album's sound. Dylan's raw vocal and sparse guitar make him sound older than his years, while the energy he has keeps the song from ever derailing into some sort of pastiche.
There's just one kind favor I'll ask of you. You can't see that my grave's kept clean. And there's two white horses following me. And there's two white horses following me.
Despite their evergreen presence, this is not a covers album. This debut does rely heavily on them and traditional songs being rearranged, which is not quite the same thing, but we also do get some Dylan originals too. The first being track two, Talking New York. The track is a talking blues song, and it appears to be fairly autobiographical, although with Dylan, given his actual autobiography, you can never be too sure. It's a result of apparently a few attempts to write a New York-based song. NYC Blues and Down at Washington Square are two other songs mentioned from this period that try and do the same thing. The lyrics are a young folk singer's first impressions of New York. It's pretty straightforward for the most part, as Dylan opens with, "Rambling out of the Wild West, leaving the towns I love the best. Thought I'd seen some ups and downs till I came into New York Town. People going down to the ground, buildings going up to the sky." With Dylan's legends now being locked into the 20th century pop culture, the song's next few verses, in hindsight, play as an almost homage to his story, or even a parody. It's like it's been written for SNL or something. All the hallmarks of what would become his legendary story are here, from coffee shops to Greenwich Village. He sings, "I swung on my old guitar, grabbed hold of a subway car. After rocking, reeling, rolling ride, I landed up on the downtown side, Greenwich Village. I walked down there and ended up in one of them coffee houses on the block. I get on the stage to sing and play. Man there said, come back some other day.
After rocking, reeling, rolling ride, I landed up on the downtown side, Greenwich Village. I walked down there and ended up in one of them coffee houses on the block. I'd get on the stage, sing and play. Man there say, come back some other day. You sound like a hillbilly. We want folk singers here.
There's another song set in the Big Apple that also shares the title of being the only Dylan original here. And for me, it's a bit of a classic. Its name is Song to Woody. It's hard to think of anybody who was as big an influence than Woody Guthrie on a young Dylan. Guthrie, as I'm sure you know, was a highly respected folk singer-songwriter. He became active in the 1930s and his career peaked around about a decade later. Dylan would borrow from Woody in almost every single way, starting with his look. Guthrie's vagabond dress was almost recreated piece by piece by Dylan. He too, like Dylan, would favour a baggy shirt, a hat and oversized jackets, all unbuttoned and thrown on. At least they looked like that. More than one former girlfriend has confirmed that Dylan would meticulously plan his outfits to look like they'd just been thrown on. Brown boots and blue jeans were favoured by both of them. There's even an outfit of Woody's where he's wearing a shirt unbuttoned over a striped t-shirt that is exactly recreated by Dylan a few years later. Even a famous early promo picture of Bob where he's holding up his guitar to his chest, his head thrown to one side, is a recreation of a Guthrie shot. Woody, of course, influenced Dylan's music as well, both in its melody and the words he set those melodies to. There's countless examples from even the most famous of Dylan's early work. Here on this song, we almost get a first-hand account of that. Dylan sings, "I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing your world of people and things, your paupers and peasants and princes and kings." Which sounds like Dylan is referencing his arrival in New York, which, as we know, is around the time he first meets Guthrie. He's come to the big city like so many before him. He's starting out like Woody did, living in his world full of paupers, peasants, princes and kings. Next, Dylan addresses Woody directly. He says, "Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song." He then continues to sing, "A funny older world that's coming along seems sick and it's hungry. I'm tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born." A lovely verse with the final line stumbling into territory that Dylan would explore more dazzlingly with the song It's Alright Ma. The lyric of "about a funny old world that's a-coming along" is a reference to the Woody Guthrie song Better World A-Coming from 1944. While more overtly, the Dylan song itself actually uses the melody of Guthrie's tune 1913 Massacre, a topical ballad that concerns the death of striking copper miners and their families in Michigan on Christmas Eve in 1913.
Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball.
Later in the song, Dylan continues to gush over Woody. He's in awe of his mentor, and during verse 3, he sings, "Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know all the things that I'm a-saying and a-many times more. I'm a-singing you the song, but I can't sing enough, because there's not many men that have done the things that you've done." In the fourth verse, he pays homage to others. He sings, "Here's to Cisco and Sonny and Lead Belly too." Sonny is possibly Sonny Terry, a blind blues musician, or perhaps even Sonny Boy Williamson. He was an American blues harmonica player and singer-songwriter. Dylan has referenced both. Dylan was a fan, though, especially of Sonny Boy, even covering him on the famous Letterman appearance in the 1980s. Lead Belly was an American folk and blues musician. He travelled with Woody, and again, Dylan was a huge fan, mentioning him many times in concerts and interviews. The Cisco is Cisco Houston, another American folk singer-songwriter he extensively recorded with Woody. Dylan finishes off this verse of Song to Woody with the lines, "And to all the good people that travelled with you, here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind." That final line there seems to be a reference to Woody too. That "come with the dust" could be a nod to Guthrie's song Pastures of Plenty and the line of "we come with the dust and we go with the wind." He also had an album called Dust Bowl Ballads as well. The final verse sees Dylan place himself firmly at the feet of Woody. He sings, "I'm a-leaving tomorrow, but I could leave today, somewhere down the road someday. The very last thing that I'd want to do is to say I've been hitting some hard travelling too." Dylan is referencing Woody's song Hard Travelling. He's making sure that while his hero is, with all due respect, a spent force, he's highlighting that Woody will always be the master, no matter what state he's in. Dylan will never experience the hardships that Woody has, the hardships Woody had to endure, so people like Dylan didn't have to.
I'm a-leaving tomorrow, but I could leave today. Somewhere down the road someday. The very last thing that I'd want to do is to say hard traveling too.
The song itself was recorded in November 61 in what would soon be Bob's creative home of Columbia's Studio A in New York City. The tune comes halfway through the session. There's two takes, and the second one is the one that makes it onto the album. Interestingly, he records the two Dylan originals next to each other in the rundowns. This entire record was captured in just 2 days and three sessions in that late November 61, coming on the 20th and the 22nd. In preparation for the record, Dylan immersed himself in the world of folk music. While he had been doing this for a while and would continue to do it on a fabled trip to England, which former Patreon subscribers will have heard discussed at length and its impact on Bob's early writing career, at this point he seems to take it up a gear. Carla Rotolo, sister of Bob's girlfriend Suze Rotolo, said he spent most of his time listening to my records, days and nights. He studied the Folkways anthology of American folk music and just read and listened to anything he could. His record was at the planning stages. We were all concerned about what songs Bob was going to do. I remember clearly talking about it. Once in the studio, Bob was very much a novice, and while Columbia didn't particularly provide a lavish recording budget, and why would they, it wasn't a straightforward experience despite only being 2 days and three sessions. Producer John Hammond remembers saying Bob popped every P and hissed every S. He habitually wandered off mic too. Even more frustrating was he refused to learn from his mistakes. It occurred to me at the time I've never worked with anyone so undisciplined before. While there were multiple attempts to get the most out of the songs during the recording, once they had a finished take, that was enough for Dylan. When asked early on if he could do a second take after getting one full take, Bob's reply was, "No, I can't see myself singing the same song twice in a row. That's just terrible." They captured 18 songs in the sessions, and because of that number, there's a few songs that don't make the album's track listing. One being House Carpenter, a traditional English ballad from the 1800s. Bob would record it here and return to it many times in his career. It's a proper touchstone for him. He cut it again on the fifth self-portrait session in 1970, appearing on the snappily titled Bootleg Series Volume 10, Another Self-Portrait, 1969 to 1971. But more interestingly, it also seems to be the base for another Dylan song, or possibly even songs. Particularly from 1989's album Oh Mercy and the brilliant composition Man in the Long Black Coat. While House Carpenter doesn't make it onto the record here, there are a fair share of traditional songs that do. House of the Rising Sun being one of the most famous.
Oh, tell my baby sister not to do what I have done, but shun that house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun.
While this is a traditional song, the arrangement is not attributed to Dylan, but to the singer-songwriter and important folk music figure, Dave Van Ronk. In Martin Scorsese's documentary No Direction Home, Van Ronk gives us the context of the song. He says, "I'd learnt it sometime in the 1950s from a recording by Hallie Wood, the Texas singer and collector. He'd got it from an Alan Lomax field recording by a Kentucky woman named Georgia Turner." Were you confused yet? "I put a different spin on it by altering the chorus and using a bass line that descended in half steps, a common enough progression in jazz, but unusual amongst folk singers. By the early 1960s, the song had become one of my signature pieces, and I could hardly get off the stage without doing it. Then one evening in 1962, I was sitting at my usual table at the back of the Kettle of Fish, and Dylan came slouching in. He'd been up in the Columbia Studios with John Hammond doing his first album. He was very mysterioso about the whole thing, and nobody had been to any of the sessions except his lady. I pumped him for information, but he was vague. He said, 'Hey, would it be okay for me to record your arrangement of House of the Rising Sun?' 'Oh, shit,' I thought. 'Geez, Bobby,' I said, 'I'm going into the studio to do that myself in a few weeks. Can't it wait until your next album?' Apparently, after a long pause, Dylan just said, 'Uh-oh.' Van Ronk continues saying, 'I did not like the sound of that.' 'What exactly do you mean, uh-oh?' 'Well,' he said sheepishly, 'I've actually already recorded it.' Which doesn't sound unlike Dylan's nature, especially at this point of his life and career. With his debut LP, in some ways, Dylan began his career with an album that would be a roadmap for it. But in other ways, it's an anomaly. As we know, the album didn't sell that well. Bob's never actually been a huge seller, especially compared to some of his contemporaries, but even in that context, it's still not that great. The album also relies heavily on traditional folk and blues songs, something that we've seen Dylan return to time and time again, the House Carpenter being a telling example. There's also a hint of religion, another touchstone for Bob, and of course, New York is present in this album as it is in the early days of Bob's career. But this record also features a slightly unevolved Dylan. In the 60s releases that would follow, he sounds supremely confident. Here he's no shrinking violet, but unusually for him, you can detect a youthful tenderness of sorts. Also, as a record, it's just not that thrilling. There are some interesting moments, some nice touches, and even some songs that would indicate what and who Bob Dylan was all about, and who he'd actually become. But there's better contemporary folk albums, and there's more exciting arrangements that aren't found here. While Bob is the best of the best, his debut album isn't a smash, which in some ways is good. I guess when all said and done, you can't have it all.
I was born in Dixie in a boomer shack, just a little shanty by the railroad track. Freight train was all taught me how to cry, humming of the drivers and the lullaby. I got the freight train blue.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. What do you think of this debut album? Do you love it? Are you a little bit indifferent about it like I am? Do you hate it? Share, please. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Bob Dylan Podcast. So on to our next episode then. And we're going to look at... do you know what? This debut album is not Dylan's worst album, as I've said in this episode. I think, though, next time we might be looking at his worst album. It's 1973's Dylan, which is not, it's kind of not even an album, really, is it? In terms of studio albums, but we're going to have a look at it anyway and work out just what a shambles it all was. But again, you know, like I always say, with these not so good albums, the context around it is often as interesting as what's going on record. Off record is often more interesting, in fact, than what's happening on record. Although sometimes you do get albums like Blood on the Tracks where the stuff that's happening off the record is as good as the stuff that's happening on the record, with changing record companies and going back to records, companies and stuff like that, and relationships too. 1973's Dylan is definitely one of those ones where a lot is happening off the record and not so much is happening on the record, but we look at both in the next episode. In the meantime, thank you once again for listening. What a pleasure it is to be back with you, and I'll see you for the next episode. Brace yourself for it.